This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
New vaccines are in the pipeline. One other surefire way to stop the spread? Tough quarantines. Go to Hong Kong, expect to spend 2 or 3 weeks in a hotel.
It's kind of day 11. That's when you start to go a bit mad.
Also today, the story of a man who led thousands of children to safety during Sudan's civil war. His son has written a book about it.
And I came to a point where I just said to myself, this story has to be told. The world needs to know about it.
We check in with how Pacific Islanders in the U.S. have fared during the pandemic.
Our rates are actually in some states 5-6 times higher than, you know, white population.
And here's some pandemic tales from the bar room.
And when I got home, I found out the city was going on lockdown. We had just opened 5 kegs of beer that night.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The global race towards vaccination continues, with new vaccines popping up, including a single-shot dose in the pipeline. But there's also new information about just how effective vaccines may be against new strains of the coronavirus. To help make sense of this, we're joined now by Saad Omer. He's the director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. Saad, we're learning today about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and its efficacy. It's a single-shot dose. First off, what does efficacy even mean? I mean, break it down for us.
So efficacy means that what is the reduction in the occurrence of an infection or a disease amongst vaccinated compared to unvaccinated. So the way we measure it is that we vaccinate a bunch of people and then there's a control group. And when we see how many in the vaccine group got the disease and how many in the control group got the disease, the comparison of it tells you what is the efficacy. And in this case, if it's for mRNA vaccines, if it's 95%, the occurrence of disease is lower by 95% in the vaccine arm compared to the control arm.
So let's apply this to this new Johnson & Johnson vaccine. They're reporting that the efficacy of this new vaccine is 72% here in the U.S. Is that good or disappointing?
It is good, but it all depends on the question, compared to what? So compared to our initial expectations and the benchmark FDA and similarly, WHO, et cetera, came up with, meant that anything above 50% would be considered a vaccine that can be used in public health program. But if you look at the efficacy compared to the two mRNA vaccines, obviously, they showed 95% efficacy. However, there's a little bit more of a nuance here. First of all, the efficacy against severe disease after 28 days of vaccination was 85%. So that's higher. So what it tells us is that these data are nuanced. We do know that we have at least 2 highly efficacious vaccines in our arsenal. And looking at these nuanced data from the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, plus the very attractive delivery characteristics, meaning it's one dose, can be refrigerated when you're deploying it, I think that will come into public health decisions.
But then there's this. Johnson & Johnson's new vaccine is only 57% effective in South Africa, where a highly contagious variant is driving most cases. So what does that tell us?
Well, that tells us that we are running this marathon at sprint speeds, and that marathon will continue. I'm not going to hide my concern. Initially, when these variants emerged, most experts had a wait-and-see approach. We now know with reasonable level of confidence that these vaccines work against the so-called UK strain and some of the other variants, etc. The South Africa variant is concerning. Having said that, 50% or 57%, as, you know, I don't recall the specific number, but it was above 50%. That efficacy is no joke either, especially the efficacy against severe disease in all cases seems to be higher than that, On top of that, I think the implication is that right now we need to have a combined strategy of other non-pharmaceutical interventions like social distancing, et cetera, and masking, plus the vaccine. So the vaccines for most of the world are not going to on their own get us out of this mess. So all of that is required. And I think we need more tools in our arsenal to combat these variants.
Why is it important that there are different types of vaccines being distributed around the world? I mean, if one vaccine works and is effective, why not just replicate that one everywhere?
So there are a few things. So that's a really good question. So when they were being developed, it was really smart to hedge our bets because we did not know which kind of an approach will work. mRNA versus the so-called vectored vaccines or a whole virus inactivated vaccines, which are like different types of vaccines that are out there. So that's one thing. The other thing is that there are bottlenecks in production capacity by type of vaccines. So manufacturing facilities are often very specific to the type of vaccine being manufactured and distributed. The third reason are the characteristics of each of these vaccines in terms of storage requirements, number of doses needed, and so on and so forth. And so having more tools in our toolbox is better than just relying on one or two tools.
What are the dangers if only some regions around the world get access to the vaccine? Or rather, some countries end up having low vaccination rates among their populations. What are the implications for that?
First of all, look, this pandemic, like all other large outbreaks, are historic events. So as a country, as a people, as humanity, when we look back, are we going to be in a situation where we say that we were so self-centered and so selfish that we let fellow humans suffer? That's not a good position to be in 5 years from now when all the panic resides. So we should think about that. But also, we have done some actual empirical work which says that after a certain level of protection, you don't have to get to 100% protection. And even well before that, it is in our interest, in the US's interest, to have high vaccine coverage throughout the world. And again, one reason, and that's not the only reason, is the emergence of variants. So if we get to the so-called herd immunity threshold, and we are protected for now, and the virus runs rampant elsewhere, that increases the possibilities, sometimes exponentially, of these variants emerging. And those new variants are less susceptible to the vaccines we use in this country, then we have a problem. So you can't have a situation where you think you have built a perfect firewall when the whole village is burning. And so it is in everyone's interest to have equity in vaccine distribution, vaccine access, and vaccine availability throughout the world.
Saad Omar is the director of the Yale Institute for Global Health. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Wuhan, the capital city of Hubei province in China, is well known across the globe as the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak. But long before the pandemic, it had a very different reputation. For the past 25 years, Wuhan had been like Seattle, a hotbed of punk and indie rock. When the world's Rebecca Kanther visited Wuhan recently, she wanted to find out what effect the pandemic has had on the live music scene. And here's what Rebecca found.
Here at Wuhan Prison, a tiny bar that fits only about 200 people, bands perform everything from punk to reggae to metal. The manager, Dong Dong, tells me last year's lockdown caught her off guard. I closed the bar at 3 a.m., and when I got home, I found out the city was going on lockdown, she says. We had just opened 5 kegs of beer that night. She says she and her staff ended up sneaking in to drink it all up before it went bad. Normally, the bar sells drinks and uses the proceeds to pay the bands that perform on stage. With a lockdown, they couldn't open their doors for months, but were still paying rent. When the lockdown was lifted in April, businesses started opening up again. But when Dong Dong tried holding a party, police came immediately to shut it down and took her to the police station for a talking to. They told me the pandemic is still very serious. You can't have people crowding in, she says. I said, you won't let me open, but I haven't had any income for months. What should I do? She sold drinks from the doorway until June, when the bar was allowed to put on shows again. Meanwhile, musicians were stuck at home too. For some, though, the forced isolation led to inspiration. Jiang Dachiao is a bartender at Wuhan Prison, and also the lead singer of Braindead, a hardcore punk band. He says while the human and economic cost of the pandemic has been enormous, the half year he was stuck with his family in his hometown in northern China was a good experience. Because I couldn't work, I had time to myself and more time to write, he says. The songs I wrote were about hardship, but not necessarily related to the pandemic. I wrote about feeling trapped, but you can feel trapped even when you're not on lockdown. Most indie musicians in China can't make a living off of music alone. Their other jobs bring in steady income. That helped many of them get by during the lockdown, though they earn extra from tours and music festival gigs. Tudo plays banjo and guitar in one of China's oldest punk bands, Shenming Zhibing, or Bread of Life. The band recorded their latest album at the end of 2019, but he says they've been unable to promote it because their lead singer has been stuck in Portugal. He went there for his honeymoon before the lockdown and still hasn't been able to get back in, he says. Not all of our songs can be published online in China because the content is politically sensitive. Without live shows, it's hard for people to hear our music. Tudo says the band hopes the lead singer can get back in the country by April in time to go on tour. Just around the corner from Wuhan Prison is a larger venue, Vox Livehouse. It also houses Wild Records, an indie label. Li Banxian works for Vox and also manages the label. He says that once shows were allowed again, audiences came back strong. College students even snuck off campus to come to the shows. They'd been at home a lot and wanted to get out and hear live music, he says. One of the bands that Li manages is Chinese Football, an indie rock band that has a strong following both in China and around the world. I stopped by the studio to hear them working on a song for their new album. Lead singer Xu Bo says he was surprised how moving it was to perform again after so long. As a musician, you need live performance, he says. You need to get that feedback from the audience. The audience they most want to play for, though, is off limits for now. The band had been planning a 15-show tour in Europe last year. It was going to be their first tour outside of Asia. But the pandemic ruined their plans. It's been postponed twice already. Now it's scheduled for August, but really, who knows? Travel restrictions also mean that foreign bands can't get in. Li says that's been a boon for musicians here. It used to be that foreign bands would sell more tickets, he says. But since they're unable to come in, the local bands are getting more opportunities. I saw many bands that used to not be able to sell tickets, all of a sudden selling pretty good. A popular reality TV show, The Big Band, is also shining a spotlight on underground indie bands. Li says venues are noticing the difference. More young people know about independent music now and want to see live shows, he says. Some of the bands that were on the show are touring and bringing in crowds. But the live music scene here still remains fragile. Li Lixing works at Vox Livehouse. He says things can change on a dime. This month, venues in different cities have had to cancel shows, he says. There's no 100% guarantee that any show will go on. Things are changing all the time. If there's an uptick in COVID cases, the government will just cancel all cultural activities to reduce the risk. As a result, Vox is taking an extended break for Chinese New Year and planning shows from March onwards, selling less tickets and with everyone wearing masks. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Whether it's the latest on the Chinese music scene or the pandemic, you spend time with The World every weekday to hear the voices and stories that connect you with faraway places. That connection continues on social media. Join the conversation about the global stories that keep you thinking. Find our team of journalists on Twitter. The handle is easy to remember. We're at The World. And you can find me tweeting about cartoonists and satire. I'm at Global Cartoons. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. For the past year, we've been profiling Latino voters here in the U.S. It's part of our Every 30 Seconds series. We call it that because every 30 seconds, a Latino turns old enough to vote. Latinos voted overwhelmingly for Joe Biden, including in some key swing states. Now Democratic strategists are looking ahead, thinking, which state is next? Naomi Prilo with Station WUNC in North Carolina has our story.
For the first time in years, Arizona and Georgia turned blue in the 2020 election.
The Associated Press calling the state of Arizona for Joe Biden. This is the first state that Joe Biden has been able to flip.
CNN has just projected President-elect Biden the winner in Georgia and President Trump the winner in North Carolina.
These flips came as no surprise to grassroots activists in both states. They say voters of color, especially Latinos, were crucial to those wins. They fought against years of anti-immigrant rhetoric and racism in their communities. Now, organizers in North Carolina are taking notes. Juan Miranda is with Siembra en Sí, a group working with Latinos in the state. He says he's excited to see the outcome.
Every election is like, you know, the Latino vote is going to make the difference for the past several elections. And the reality is that in those two states, the actual impact that the Latino vote had was the result of the amazing work, the organizing work that took place for years to mobilize those folks.
Close to a million Latinos live in North Carolina. In 2020, Latino voter turnout was almost three times higher than in 2016. And Miranda says that matters because their impact will only continue to grow. Political scientists say more people are moving to North Carolina, including Latinos, because the pandemic has made it easier to work remotely. Even with that growth, some think it might take a few elections for the state to turn blue. Change, however, is already brewing in historically conservative counties.
We ready. We ready. We ready for change. Everybody say.
That's from a recent Black Lives Matter march in Alamance County, about 1 hour west of Raleigh in the middle of the state. The march was encouraging people to go to the polls just a few days before Election Day. The county is known for its cooperation with immigration officials and raids targeting mostly undocumented Latinos. It's also the county where residents still want a Confederate statue in one of its downtown squares. Organizers say these protests are a result of changing views and demographics. Latinos make up only 3% of the state's eligible voters, but it's important to keep educating them about the political process, especially as their numbers grow, says Chris Patino. He's with the North Carolina Hispanic Republican Coalition.
Are not very familiarized with what Democrats stand for and what Republicans stand for. They just know what they're told.
Most of North Carolina's rural counties voted for former President Donald Trump. And Patino says, even with a Democratic governor, the state still holds on to very conservative values. But despite his own political affiliation, Patino says he feels neutral about the state going blue in the future.
I'd love to see what we can accomplish as Latinos and we can help this state accomplish. Do I want to see North Carolina going blue or red? Time will tell. We'll see what the leadership does these next couple of years.
Juan Miranda, the organizer with Siembra en Sí, says now is the time to take inspiration from Georgia and start getting aggressive.
A lot of our organizing happens in rural areas, so we're going to continue growing in those places by mobilizing folks around, once again, issues that affect them.
If states like Georgia had that success, Miranda says he's hopeful for North Carolina's future. For The World, I'm Naomi Prilo in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Communities of color have been disproportionately hard hit by the pandemic. This is not news. It's true in the U.S., in Europe, and other parts of the world. In this country, we hear a lot about infection rates among Latinos and Blacks, but not as much about Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders. Alisi Tulua is project director at UCLA for the Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander COVID-19 Data Policy Lab. She spoke with my colleague, Marco Werman.
Alisa, you've been tracking the infection rates in Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander communities. What does the data tell us?
Well, much of the narrative around the data for COVID in this past week has been that there's a flattening in many communities. However, when we look at case rates per 100,000 and death rates per 100,000 for Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islanders, there's still a steep increase in our communities with regards to COVID.
And the actual numbers, I mean, I saw somewhere that in Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander communities, that's where we find the highest prevalence of COVID in the U.S. Is that right?
That's right. When you take the population size into account, our case rates and our death rates are higher than all other race and ethnic groups.
So why are we not hearing more about this?
I believe it's because we're a small community. Altogether, our total population makes up maybe 2% of the entire population of the country. And so as a small community, you know, you're often looked at as too small to matter. And then in reality, a lot of our data is suppressed because it's not disaggregated. So many times you see our Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander data grouped into the Asian and Pacific Islander category. So there's an invisibility there.
So small communities in actual numbers, but this high rate among Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders, does that tell us something more generally about the U.S. response to the pandemic?
Well, when you look at the rates, which takes the population into account, our rates are actually in some states 5-6 times higher than, you know, white population, which reflects the disparity in response with regards to resources in terms of getting our community tested and being able to provide financial assistance and housing assistance. This also reflects the disparity that you see in comorbidities that makes COVID even more severe in our population. We have high rates of diabetes, heart disease, many of the underlying conditions that makes a community more vulnerable. And unfortunately, the reaction in terms of being able to provide support has also been lacking.
Alisi, what is your reaction to the news that states like California, where you live, are easing their lockdown restrictions?
Our largest population outside of the state of Hawaii is in California. And when you look at our data, our numbers are continuing to grow. And even when you hear stories from communities about, you know, several deaths within the same family, this isn't easing up for us. Many of our families live in multi-generational homes where you have grandparents living with even their grandkids. And, you know, the younger generation that have to go to work and are usually essential workers. And so with the easing of the restrictions in California, it means that there is higher probability for exposure for our essential workers that then come home and potentially bring something home to their parents and grandparents who might have underlying conditions already. So it's a bit scary for us, but it's also an opportunity for our folks that are doing the work on the ground to think more creatively about how to stretch the little bit of resources that we have, how to work more closely with our community to continue to encourage them to stay safe, because many of us are saying that this is getting closer. If it hasn't already gotten into our homes, it's getting closer and closer to our families.
So I hear the obstacles, Alisi. What gives you the most hope that things are moving in the right direction for this community?
What gives me the most hope is opportunities like this to be able to get the information out beyond our own communities. We're always talking to each other and trying to figure out what we can do. The lack of visibility and awareness is one of our biggest barriers.
Alisi Talua is project director for the Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander COVID-19 Data Policy Lab at UCLA. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to The World. The vaccine rollout in the U.S. has not been great. In the European Union, it's been a downright mess.
This could get quite nasty in the sense that vaccine nationalism, which is something we haven't seen until now, could be beginning to rear its head.
And a Vietnamese-American writer looks back on his dad's life and his own, caught between two worlds. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. The UK now has one of the highest COVID death rates per capita in the world. One way to stop the spread, put people in quarantine hotels. Travelers now flying into Britain from 30 countries will soon have to stay in a government-selected isolation hotel at their own cost. And rooms aren't just required for non-UK nationals. Brits will need a reservation, too. From London, The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports on how things have gotten to this point in the UK.
Scottish national Ian Sampson knows a thing or two about quarantine hotels. He's staying in one right now in Hong Kong. Today is day 4.
It's not too bad. I work flexibly, so I'm working from the room. It's kind of day 11 or 12. I've heard a couple of other people also saying that's when you start to go a bit mad.
Sampson flew back to his home in Hong Kong from the UK this week and faces 21 days of quarantine in a hotel he has to pay for. It's costing him the equivalent of $2,500. He paid an extra $900 for a room with a window, but he says it's worth it. Samson hasn't seen any other guests since he arrived.
The only people you see are kind of people walking in the corridor with hazmat suits on, collecting your rubbish or bringing you deliveries.
Samson's been keeping an eye on news from the UK, following reports that Britain is planning its own hotel quarantine scheme for passengers arriving from what it calls high-risk countries. These are places, the government says, which appear to have different mutant strains of the virus. Most of the countries on the list are in South America and Southern Africa. Priti Patel, the British Home Secretary, says the plan is also aimed at stopping Brits going on holidays. Plenty have been seen doing so in the last few weeks, against government guidelines.
Border Force have given me examples where even at St Pancras, people have been turning up with their skis. We see plenty of influencers on social media showing off about which parts of the world that they are in.
Over 100,000 people have now died from COVID-19 in the UK. In a TV press conference this week, Prime Minister Boris Johnson told the country he takes responsibility for the government's handling of the virus.
I should just really repeat that I am deeply sorry for every life that has been lost. And of course, as Prime Minister, I take full responsibility for everything that the government has done.
And given the circumstances, he said, his government has done its best.
We truly did everything we could and continue to do everything that we can to minimise loss of life and to minimise suffering in what has been a very, very difficult stage.
But many disagree with Johnson, including the scientists. Michael Head is an infectious disease expert at the University of Southampton. He says the government has failed not once, but repeatedly when it comes to implementing national lockdowns.
I think you probably could excuse that first time out with the first lockdown back in March 2020. But thereafter, with the lockdowns, it came weeks too late, and that was against expert advice, which did say at the time we need to lock down several weeks earlier.
Head says Johnson likely caved into pressure from his own MPs and business lobby groups. But there are other issues. Britain is a densely populated country, so the virus has been able to spread quickly, pretty much everywhere. It has an ageing population too, with high levels of obesity and diabetes. And it's a deeply unequal society in terms of wealth. Here's epidemiology professor Michael Marmot speaking to the UK's Channel 4 News.
Life expectancy was declining for the poorest people outside London. And then the pandemic made everything worse. It exposed the underlying inequalities in society and amplified them.
Then there's the NHS, Britain's revered publicly financed healthcare system, which up until quite recently has seen its funding pretty much frozen. Infectious disease expert Michael Head says lack of government investment has had fatal consequences.
We saw at the start of the pandemic that we didn't have much in the way of PPE stored. We didn't really have much in the way of ventilators, and we didn't have much in the way of pandemic plans ready, despite the fact that there were simulation exercises done in 2016. The results from that exercise were not taken on board and implemented.
So now that Britain has reached the grim milestone of having the highest death rate per capita in Europe, will quarantine hotels help? Well, New Zealand introduced isolation hotels in April of last year, and its death toll from COVID-19? Just 25 people. But travel consultant Paul Charles says it's unfair to compare the two countries.
The UK is not like Australia or New Zealand. It's very different here. The UK is more connected to neighbouring Europe, whereas from Australia and New Zealand, you'd be flying for many hours. And a lot of people have chosen to live and work in the UK because of its proximity to France, to Spain, to Belgium, to Germany, etc.
Keir Starmer, the opposition Labour Party leader, has called for hotel quarantine to be introduced for all passengers flying into Britain. Charles, who runs the PC agency, is vehemently opposed to the idea.
I don't agree with blanket quarantine. I think any quarantine measures are a backward step and put people off. They remove confidence to book future business and leisure travel.
Charles thinks quarantining at home is still the way to go. There are some bright spots on the horizon for Britain. The number of people testing positive for COVID has dropped in the last few weeks. And as the government likes to state, at every possible opportunity, the UK's vaccine rollout is one of the fastest in the world. Still, as Ian Sampson in Hong Kong says, it's nice to be in a place where you feel the government has the virus under control. Right now, he's pretty sanguine about his hotel quarantine experience.
You've got to have it in perspective. You know, some people don't get to see their family at all. And, you know, I knew what I signed up for, and I can't complain too much. It's working out okay for me.
Then again, he reminds me, it's only day 4 of 21 days in isolation. Ring me again on day 20, he says, and you might get a very different response. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
So that's the view from the UK. Now let's look at the vaccine rollout in the rest of Europe. That's a topic discussed in a recent episode of the podcast The Intelligence, brought to us by our partners at Economist Radio. Jason Palmer is the host. Jason, what's going on in the EU with the vaccine rollout?
Well, in short, it's a mess, and I can give you some figures. To date, the EU has vaccinated 2.5% of its population. In Britain, that number is nearly 12. In the US, it's almost 8. And there are a lot of factors here, but the point is that the EU is way behind on the promises that it's made. The bloc has spent billions and billions of euros, some of it, for example, to build capacity for vaccine manufacture in Britain as well. And the pharma companies themselves are being slow to deliver. And of course, that's causing a lot of blame to be passed around. On our podcast, we spoke to Sophie Petter, the Paris bureau chief for The Economist, and she said it's a really patchy picture. Each country should, in principle, be at the same point, but there are 27 different health systems. Health isn't managed at the EU level, it's managed by each country. In France, for example, it's centralized. In Germany, it's decentralized. So you have this patchwork of different health systems and campaigns and plans.
Of course, the U.S. has a similar patchwork. It works a little differently, but I'm wondering, in the EU, are countries just being left on their own to figure things out?
More or less, yes. And even within countries, there's confusion. To get a look at this, Sophie went along to the French town of Poissy, northwest of Paris. Now, France is normally thought of as having a good health system, but they've been really slow at this rollout. In Poissy, they have the first place to open a vaccination center outside a hospital or nursing home, and Sophie went along to see how things were going.
What really struck me talking to the mayor there and about how he'd gone about opening this centre was that in order to get round the rules imposed by an extremely bureaucratic centralised system, you've got to take the initiative, you've got to keep hitting the phones, you've got to call up, you've got to say, we're ready, please give us authorisation and we will start vaccinating. Because otherwise you'll find that a lot of people on the ground are just waiting, or at least are used to waiting for instructions to come down from on high. And what I saw in Poissy was the exact opposite of that, and how actually people on the ground can make a difference if governments are able to sort of incorporate them into the process.
It sounds a bit like here in the US last year when states were fighting for PPE. It seems like the issue all comes down to supplies. I mean, I know there's been important discussions going on all week between the EU and pharma companies. Where are those discussions going?
That's right. AstraZeneca warned a week ago that it wasn't going to be able to meet its orders to the EU, and Pfizer-BioNTech had already pushed back their promised deliveries of vaccines by a few weeks. And meanwhile, people are understandably frustrated. There have been riots in the Netherlands about curfews there. France has been under a curfew since December. Leaders are frankly struggling to manage expectations at this point. On one hand, there's the light at the end of the tunnel in the form of the vaccines, but now there are questions around the supply of them. And there's a certain sense of injustice that comes with that, and I think that's going to continue to be a problem. Here's Sophie Petter on that again.
There's a sense of deep frustration that the orders that have been placed by the European Commission, which thought that it was acting on behalf of, in a sense of sort of solidarity on behalf of all its 27 member states, in ordering these vaccines and making sure that they could guarantee the supply on a fair basis to every country, that's now in jeopardy because AstraZeneca says it won't be able to deliver as expected. The EU is considering whether to retaliate with export restrictions on the Pfizer vaccine, which is produced in Belgium, one of the EU member states. And this could get quite nasty in the sense that vaccine nationalism, which is something we haven't seen until now, could be beginning to rear its head.
And that clip, of course, is from your podcast, The Intelligence. Jason, vaccine nationalism, is that where we're at? I just heard Sophie Petter tell you things could get quite nasty.
Well, in a way, that's kind of already starting. The European Commission, the EU's executive body, has actually published its contract with AstraZeneca, trying to sort of show that it is, in fact, being wronged here. These contracts are normally kept quite close, quite secret, in fact. AstraZeneca, for its part, offered 8 million more doses of the vaccine to the EU to try to kind of calm things down, but the EU replied that was still far short of what was originally promised. And of course, there's something of a zero-sum game going on here. What the EU gets has to come from somewhere. Here in Britain, the suggestion that the EU was angling for some of the British supply was met with immediate public fury. I mean, the good part is that more vaccines are coming online. We're seeing more efficacy results coming thick and fast. So relief is coming. But I fear there's going to be more of this blame game, these harsh words, and frankly, anger.
Jason Palmer is the host of the Intelligence Podcast, brought to us by our partners at Economist Radio. To hear more of Jason's conversation with Sophie Petter, just go to wherever you get your podcasts. Jason Palmer, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carol.
Nearly a decade ago, millions of people voted to create the world's newest nation, South Sudan. That came after more than two decades of violent civil war. Millions of people were displaced, many of them children, who became known as the Lost Boys and Girls. Now, people from the vibrant South Sudanese diaspora are eager to tell their stories. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, spoke with one former refugee who's written a memoir about his family's experience.
Yuo Tajonga Lok has come a long way from his days as a child refugee. He's now in his 40s, lives in Australia with his wife and three children, makes a good living working as an engineer at a mining company. Still, he's never been able to forget the arduous journey that brought him to where he is today.
I carried this story for so long, and I came to a point where I just said to myself, this story has to be told. The world needs to know about it.
Yuot was born in Bor Town, which back then was still part of Sudan. The country would soon be engulfed in a civil war, as South Sudanese, who were mostly Black, African, and Christian, fought for their independence. Yuot's family fled to escape the violence, walked hundreds of miles to Ethiopia, then to Kenya. About 5 years ago, Yuot began writing these memories down in bits and pieces.
I just made time to write. I wrote on the train on my way into the city to work. I wrote on planes, and I wrote at mining camps.
Yuot's memoir was released last year in Australia, and it's also available in the United States. It begins not with war or violence, but with a moment of joy, a scene of women dancing and singing. They're celebrating the birth of Yuot's father. He's the hero of this memoir, which is aptly titled Father of the Lost Boys.
Not only is he a great man, but he's a very humble man, a very intelligent man, who has also done a tremendous service to our country.
His father, Mitak Ajang Alak, is in his 70s. He's a former school teacher who was once jailed and tortured by Sudanese authorities. Yet he continued fighting for South Sudan's independence. More remarkably, he helped lead 20,000 South Sudanese child refugees to safety, from refugee camps in Ethiopia to Kenya. Medak says he felt it was his duty as a teacher.
I felt responsible because I was a teacher, and I thought that my country and my parents have given me the upper hand to be educated. So when I led the Lost Boys, that was a responsibility. And also, I wanted them to have the education.
Not everyone agreed with him, says Michak. Some wanted the South Sudanese children to become child soldiers. At one point, even his son, Yuot, was trained as a child soldier, taught to use an AK-47. Still, Michak insisted that the children should be led to safety so they could continue with their education.
That was my philosophy. We were not shared by so many. People thought that the gun was the solution, and I was not one of them.
Michak and other teachers led the thousands of lost boys and girls to relative safety at a new refugee camp in Kenya. Since his son's memoir was released, Michak has been receiving messages from former child refugees all over the world.
Even those who have gone to the United States, those who are in Canada and here, I'm getting all with messages and thank you, you have saved our life, you have opened our eyes, and so many beautiful things.
Yuo tells me he's been getting messages, too, from former child refugees, thanking him for telling their story authentically. He says it wasn't easy. The memoir is filled with harrowing scenes of aerial bombardment, of his friends drowning as they crossed crocodile-infested rivers.
Those events were quite traumatic, but putting them down to the page was also, I felt, a sense of relief. So it was like I'd been released of this burden.
Yuot is one of many in the South Sudanese diaspora beginning to document their stories. Peter Deng is another South Sudanese refugee living in Australia. He owns a publishing house called Africa World Books. Deng says he's seeing more and more interest in writing memoirs among the South Sudanese diaspora, and not just in Australia.
People have developed interest, and the good thing about them now, they don't worry about money, so they want to leave their stories, make them public and made available. So I think there are authors who are ready to publish their books.
Deng says there's a need for more reading materials produced by South Sudanese people who traditionally come from oral cultures. Deng says he worries that the recent history of the people of South Sudan could be lost.
It is a good country with a lot of rich information, but if it is not documented now, then we're going to miss it because those who have experience are aging.
Deng says this keeps him up at night. He tries to make book writing accessible for everyone. Instead of requiring full-length manuscripts, he'll publish small booklets. For Deng, it's important to get this history into print. These days, he says young South Sudanese are coming into his bookstore, keen to learn more about their roots.
There are language books being written in some of the books about traditions, cultures, but most of the book are about liberation struggle.
The South Sudanese diaspora is spread across the world, in countries like Australia and the United States. Many of these young people don't remember South Sudan or were born abroad. Deng says their interest in these new books will help keep their history alive. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi, Kenya.
Immigrant parents often go to extraordinary lengths to preserve the culture and history of the old country. Their kids, on the other hand, they want to adapt and adapt fast. Learn the new language, pop culture, fit in. The new country is their country. For Vietnamese-American writer Andrew Lam, there was an added heaviness to his experience as an immigrant kid growing up in California. His father had spent 25 years as a decorated senior military officer in the South Vietnamese Army defending his country. In April 1975, when he fled to the United States with his family, it was in defeat. Andrew Lam's father, Lam Guan Thi, died 10 days ago of COVID. He was 88. Andrew Lam is in Vietnam, and because of the pandemic, he cannot fly home for his father's funeral. He'll attend via Zoom. Andrew, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you so much.
Your father took the loss of his country hard. How did that express itself as you were growing up? I mean, you were 11 in 1975 when you were relocated to the U.S.
Well, you know, my father was really an extraordinary person. He, even though he never overcame the loss of Vietnam, he nevertheless, for lack of a better word, soldiered on in America. He went on to study for an MBA in night school after having gotten a bachelor's degree in political science, and then worked for the Bank of America and rose to the rank of assistant vice president when he retired. And yet, with all that achievement in America for someone who came to America at 43 and remade himself, Vietnam was never far from the center of his life. So his American life, let's say, was more like a front to him. And at the end of the day, when we all gather for dinner, for instance, the conversation inevitably comes back to Vietnam, to what had happened and his memory of his childhood in the Mekong Delta, you know, his French-speaking relatives and his culture in that era. And all was about this longing for this home that is lost. So in many ways, he never abandoned that exile identity that basically defined him.
Your father was 43 when he arrived in the U.S. in 1975, but he'd already achieved a lot and basically lived an entire life. Tell us about his life in Vietnam.
Yeah, he became the youngest Vietnamese to become general in the South Vietnamese Army. But before that, he ran the Võ Bi military school in Dalat, where it sort of modeled itself after West Point and had a lot of help from actually West Point itself. But in terms of how us children saw him, he was so much larger than life because he was tall, he was dark-skinned, he spoke fluent French, and he taught himself English. He had American advisors coming to the house. He was also considered an intellectual because of his French education. So he was sort of a jack of all trades.
It's interesting you're describing a life in Vietnam, which sounds kind of fancy. And I know things were dramatically different in the early years in the U.S. I mean, how did your father adapt from being kind of a very important and accomplished person in Vietnam to kind of losing everything and having to start over in those early years in California?
It was not easy. I mean, the first year in America, I think he was in a near vegetative state, and it was my mom who was the one that took care of us and forced him to sort of wake up from his stupor. But after that, he, you know, decided that he had to do something in order to bring us out of poverty. Being typical of my father, he actually had a plan and then had this sort of discipline, which is, you know, something that he had gained from being in the military for 25 years, to work and to study at the same time. And, you know, and finally, we got out of poverty within 3 years and bought our first house by the third year in America. And I remember being so happy by then, you know, moving out of this crowded refugee apartment, and our American dream started. And, you know, I remember him driving us to Disneyland. You know, thanks to him, I had a relatively comfortable life growing up in America.
So your father had a battle plan and he carried it out, and he was victorious.
Yeah, I think that's the case. He woke up at 5 each morning, exercised, studied, and then went to work, and then went home, went to class to get his MBA, you know. And he always said this, which makes it really difficult for his children. He always say, if I had come to America at your age, it would have been easy to get a PhD. So I don't understand, why don't you all get a PhD?
Oh, boy. As you got older and made your own decisions about the life you wanted to lead, how did that work out with your dad? Was he understanding, or did he have a problem with it?
I had gone to Berkeley with my parents' expectation of being a pre-med, and then later on going on to become a doctor, which is what my father and mother kind of wanted. But I ended up graduating and then going into creative writing. And my father had challenged me. I remember he said, well, you know, I love writing, I love poetry, but how do you make a living in America writing creative writing? And can you name for me a Vietnamese in America making a living in English, writing in English? And I looked at my dad and I say, well, Dad, it's going to be me. And I think that was the moment when he started to see me in a different light, that I actually had my own game plan, that I had my own desires and path that I wanted to walk. Since then, he began to respect me more.
Did your father ever go back to Vietnam?
No, never. To me, which is a very sad thing. When he passed away 10 days ago, I, you know, not being religious, but made a prayer to him and say, well, now you're free to come back. Now that you're no longer bound by earth, you can come back and see your beloved homeland and go see whatever you needed to see. He would never go back because he was sworn to the idea that he can never go home until Vietnam itself has become a multi-party system and a democracy. And he didn't live to see that day, but he longed for Vietnam. And of course, and so to me, his love for his country, his passion for Vietnam sort of continued to inform me. And I have to say that because of his passing, that I too begin to learn to love Vietnam in similar way. And I'm not sure, I mean, I'm still struggling to understand it myself, whether or not I want to help this country on behalf of my father, or because I really love this country. But be it as it may, I make a mental commitment in my mind that I want to help Vietnam improve, perhaps to honor my dad.
We've been speaking to Vietnamese-American writer Andrew Lam about his father, Lam Quan Thi, who was a trilingual former general, banker, writer, high school teacher, and many other things. Lam Quan Thi died of COVID on January 19th. Andrew, thanks for sharing your memories of your father.
Thanks for talking with me.
That will do it for this Friday. We're back next week from the Nan and Bill Harris studio here at GBH in Boston. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.